son, because I wanted to cover quite a lot of material today. So we're reading these, this one essay from Sixu's work. The essay, and in fact the volume in which it appeared, they came out in 1977, and I thought we could start by distinguishing that moment from our own. Sixu was writing in an insurgent moment, a moment that commentators have subsequently dubbed second wave feminism. This was a time when women in the US and Western Europe were articulating a series of powerful demands for emancipation, for parity in law and the marketplace, for sexual freedom, for reproductive rights. I think of abortion on demand, access to contraception, etc. In some states, even the ability to hold a job if you were unmarried. For instance, you couldn't work, you couldn't get a permanent job as a school teacher in many parts of Southern Europe until the late 70s, early 80s. Look at the seven demands of the UK Women's Liberation Movement, the International Women's Day, that's 1971, and then also the National Women's Liberation Conference, 75, and again in 78. And we see a gradual development of a language here, moving towards a broad statement in 78, freedom from intimidation by threat or use of violence or sexual coercion, etc. So that a period in which these claims, these demands were being made, many of them, of course, still unsatisfied. So equal pay now, equal education and job opportunities, even when those demands or claims have been written into the law, they're still often not followed. It's still the case that that women are paid less for the same job as men, and of course the access to various jobs is denied women in significant ways. So within second wave feminism, there's a fairly sharp divide between those who campaigned for equality and those who emphasized difference. And those two different different emphases are worth spending some time thinking about. So if we think on the one hand the idea of equality, so this would be equal rights under the law and so on, an emphasis on difference is more an argument for less for redistribution, if you like, and more for recognition in some sense. And so we can speak of equality feminists and difference feminists, if you like. And many difference feminists, and especially in the United States, have argued for and promoted a revaluation of the feminine or of women's special family-based drives or values, depending on how these are thought about. If you look at Carol Gilligan, for instance, one of the more important of the difference feminists. Here men represent powerful activity, women in contrast portray acts of nurturance and acts of strength. She's careful here not to resort to an essentialist argument about men are, women are. It's rather that language of represent on the one hand, portray on the other. So we're speaking still about socially encoded gender roles. And nevertheless, there's a strong emphasis here on the difference between men and women, and in some sense a non-judgment about that on the part of the difference feminists, believing that there are inherent and significant differences between the sexes. Difference feminists have typically emphasized the unique identity of women as a group, stressing and usually celebrating supposed essential or at least fundamental female characteristics that they believe make women different from men. In France, though, the argument that tended to prevail was that civil and political demands for equality were not only indispensable, but also needed to be asserted in the articulation of sexual difference. So here, Luce Irigaray, often read in conjunction with Sixou, writing in the 1970s. And we see Irigaray talking about here a double demand for equality and difference. Even if you're emphasizing the question of difference for Irigaray, women are obviously not to be expected to renounce equality in the sphere of civil rights, she suggests. So the insistence on the double demand for equality and difference was accompanied by an awareness of the dangers of subordinating the question of difference to the more transparently political question of equality. That sense of in the demand for equality, what happens to difference? And again, Irigaray speaks, she says, when women's movements challenge the forms and nature of political life, they are in fact working towards a modification of women's status. On the other hand, when these same movements aim simply for a change in the distribution of power, leaving intact the power structure itself, then they are resubjecting themselves, deliberately or not, to a phallocratic order. This latter gesture must, of course, be denounced, and with determination, since it may constitute a more subtly concealed exploitation of women. Think back, if you will, to the beginning of last term when we read Habermas. And Habermas made the argument there that what was the challenge posed by bourgeois publicness, he said, Öffentlichkeit, was that, as he put it, it offered to change domination as such. What it proposed entailed not just an exchange of the basis of legitimation while domination was maintained in principle. The suggestion being, in other words, that in some way, if you think of the demand for difference, the demand for equality along with the demand for difference, you begin to realize that politics might take on a wholly different form. That in some sense it isn't a question of merely getting women through the door, admission to zones or areas where women have been excluded from. If you think of one understands this negatively, for instance, by thinking of how politics has not changed by the emergence to power or near power of women like these. That sense of when women's movements challenge the forms and nature of political life, they are in fact working towards a modification of women's status. But when they don't, when, in other words, they leave politics entirely unformed, but merely make the demand for women's admission to them, for the French feminists at the end of the 1970s, that would never be sufficient. So for them, it's not a matter of saying class or sex, if you like, but class and sex. Important then to locate the specificity of sexual oppression within the wider considerations of oppression. And so the French feminists often go back to Marx and especially to Engels, who argued that the family had always been the privileged locus of women's exploitation. So let's think a little bit more about the role that the category of sexual difference plays in the work of Sixou, in Irigaray, Julia Kristeva, in Monique Wittig, in a whole variety of theorists and writers at this time. If we make a brief tour through Freud's writings on femininity and female sexuality, looking at Freud's essay on femininity, has anybody... Is that essay read, even in the psychoanalysis modules? I'm not so sure it is. It's a fantastic essay. It's a very short essay, just called On Femininity. It's very inadvertently funny on a number of occasions, not least as Freud starts out, locates the three or four women in the audience at the public address given, and is talking about femininity and says, it addresses them and says, you are yourselves the problem, as the sense of trying to, you know, what do women want is the sort of subtitle of the text. And he gets into it. He makes some tremendously radical claims and makes some tremendous blunders as well, it seems to me. In the essay, he begins with the apparent obviousness of sexual difference. When you meet a human being, he says, the first distinction you make is male or female, and you're accustomed to make the distinction with unhesitating certainty, he says. So the sense of the obviousness of sexual difference is what Freud begins by speaking about. And then one crucial question that derives from the evidence of sexual difference is, if we say this, so if sexual difference is acknowledged, what difference does that difference make? And this is a political question, obviously. From the premise of sexual difference, what difference does it make? Does it follow from the obvious difference between men and women, as Freud sees it, that women should be barred from certain forms of employment, that women should get less money, that women should be denied access to driving licenses, for instance, or alternatively, the ability to speak in public, etc. Hearing from Rhode Island, for instance, the American Civil Liberties Union, when girls are only invited to dances and fashion shows, they stop developing interests in other areas and must stop promoting gender differences. So the argument here is not so much the suggestion that that sexual difference should be disavowed in law. It's that difference should not be made the basis for differential treatment, is the suggestion here. In general, we can say that there's a pretty direct relation between the supposed fact of sexual difference and the social inscription of women as inferior or less capable. Certainly, women are less rewarded, remunerated, etc., socially. So here's the Council of Europe gender equality strategy, which is quite recent, I think 2011-12, quite strongly. Stereotyping becomes problematic when it's used as a vehicle to degrade and discriminate women. I mean, the language of stereotyping is not quite the same thing as the language of the obviousness of sexual difference. But if you substitute Freud's language for that, you can say that the statements about sexual difference become problematic when they're used as a vehicle to degrade and discriminate against women. Abolishing negative gender stereotypes is essential to achieving gender equality. Here's the filled research chair positions in Canada as of 2014. So research chairs, the highest positions in the academy, professorships, endowed professorships, etc. 27% women, 73% men. And so some statistics from the US context, this is UK context, is about 10 years old. 10% of senior judiciary are female, 11% of top business managers, etc. What one sees, in other words, is that there is a social slide, if you like, from the premise of sexual difference to the fact of sexual domination, or domination on the basis of sex. Here's a percentage of computing professors who are men in blue, women in pink, for gender stereotyping. But I was pleased to see that Warwick, although you can't actually see any pink on the Warwick, seems to be zero, but it's not listed at the bottom. Or maybe that, and they're not quite alphabetical, are they? Because University of Exeter is above Durham, so they must be. Maybe there's one statistically insignificant at Warwick, but in any case, one. And so in computing, presumably a masculine science. So that even though women are statistically much fewer women have professorships, in British universities, that figure rises obviously in the sciences dramatically. So two dimensions of this dominant ideology might be emphasized. First, that it's essentialist at the level of sex. Second, that it conflates sex and gender. So essentialism might be defined as the belief that there are certain properties that are possessed by specific groups, by human beings, for instance, or bees, or tigers, or women, that make the individual members of those groups themselves. And when one speaks, for instance, of the way in which tigers act, and one suggests they act in tigerish kinds of ways, that's an essentialist argument, but one which has some basis in biology. The argument about sexual difference doesn't necessarily follow in that regard. So those if you're arguing essentialistically, you're arguing that those properties are universal for those groups and not dependent on context. So in the context of feminist theory, we might see the slogan "biology is destiny" as essentialist. It understands sex as innate, as immutable, as given by nature. It assumes not only that there's an essential difference between men and women, but that what men and women intrinsically are can be specified through reference to the sexual difference. So you find comments about men are by nature more aggressive than women, and women are by nature more nurturing than men. Think of those kinds of slogans, boys will be boys. An essentialist argument which slips from sex to gender in fundamental ways. Now, it's this obviousness of the sex-gender articulation that Freud attacks in his essay. He insists, on the contrary, that on the social or cultural production of men and women. As he puts it here, he says, psychoanalysis shouldn't try to tell us what a woman is, but to tell us how she comes into being, how a woman develops out of a child with a bisexual disposition. You can hear already, Freud is talking in the 1910s here, I think the essay is 1910, the radicalism of this postulate at this point needs to be registered. This sense of both the thesis of bisexuality, of course, but also the argument that the development of gender identities is not in any sense a natural phenomenon. It's not a question of a kind of a biological unfolding for Freud. The idea then looms in Freud's work that gendered identity is to be understood as an effect of the workings of society. One behaves in feminine ways, not as an expression of one's sex, but as an actor playing a given script. Femininity is performed, not expressed. You can move directly, obviously, from Freud here to performance theory in Judith Butler or somebody like this in a book like Gender Trouble. Femininity is performed, not expressed. There's been a paradigm shift in recent years in conceptions of the body and of bodiliness, embodiment. Formerly, the body was dominantly conceptualized as a fixed and unitary, primarily physiological reality. Today, more and more scholars have come to regard the body as a historical, plural, culturally mediated form. So the body has been taken for feminist theory as a text, in some sense, which can be read, decoded, but more particularly the body understood not simply as natural. So there has been feminism has been decisive to that shift, to the corollary development then of a political understanding of the body, and to a new suspicion of the category of nature and its accompanying ideologies concerning women's species role, etc. Think of Foucault, who in some ways articulates this difference, although with no particular interest in feminism or in women's situation particularly. When theorists like Butler come to read Foucault, they need to, in a sense, take his arguments and pull them across so that they become politicized with respect to women. So in his essay on femininity, Freud ends up, this is the strange thing about the essay, having made these really radical statements early on, he ends up at the end by returning gender to sex as its substrate through the absurd argument about penis envy, for instance, about castration. I mean, this is where the essay lapses into what we can't read anymore with a straight face, in some sense. His model of sexual difference is charged also with masculine bias. The male sex for Freud is normative, is constitutive, and so on. Here, you know, in other words, the sense of men are people, women are people with waists, and this one particular formulation. That particular sense is that the notion of humanity is more on maleness, masculinity, men. Which means that women are in a sense to be understood as excess, as deviation, as something other. It's that notion, obviously, that is attacked by the French feminist theorists. So despite the radical perspective opened up by psychoanalysis, Freud's theory of femininity is really a theory of masculinity and its others. This is the great problem. Freud insists on sexual difference. He says the first thing we do is to distinguish men from women. But then he says that there is only actually one sex, which is obviously contradictory. So we insist on sexual difference, men and women, and then we have a theory in which there's only one sex, men and non-men, which is not a theory of sexual difference, but a theory of sexual indifference, you could say, in Freud. So there's really only one sex. So here we move to the question, this is Irigaray again, the sexual indifference of psychoanalysis. Freud doesn't see two sexes, he sees only one. The feminine is always described in terms of deficiency or atrophy. There's this extraordinary reading in Freud where the infant, the little girl, sees the little boy, and the way in which Freud formulates it is that she sees, I can't remember the exact language, something, but she sees his equipment and how much superior it is to hers. It's a remarkable thing. So we're to imagine a scene in which the little girl sees the little boy's penis and immediately feels herself inferior. She wants one like it, is what Freud says. Exactly where Freud gets this, where does this notion of kind of desire come from? It's pure fabulation, etc. It doesn't work the other way around either. The little boy sees the little girl but doesn't seem to feel this. Does this mean that women's sexual evolution can never be characterized with reference to the female sex itself? All Freud's statements describing feminine sexuality overlook the fact that the female sex might possibly have its own specificity. So Irigaray then develops this concept of what she calls, English would be homosexuality, playing on the notion of one, but also of the notion of homme, man. So that sense of man and his other is for her what's involved. This is only a conversation between men. So the feminist project in these terms works as follows. Either, it seems, one accepts the theory of sexual difference, or one doesn't. There are lots of reasons for arguing against sexual difference. Not least the sense of, is sexual difference as obvious, as given, as Freud suggests it is? Perhaps, in fact, there are not two sexes, but a million. How does one work with the idea? Perhaps a million or perhaps none, we might argue. If, though, you work with the idea of sexual difference, then that you want to insist that that difference makes a difference. So that then you have to come up with new non-masculist theories of humankind. If the feminist demand is for the substantiality of this difference, then an emphasis on the difference that difference makes, and that involves both a deconstructive and a reconstructive labor. And it's there, it seems to me, that Cixous' work enters the frame. We can be agnostic on this question, I think, is what Irigaray, or for that matter, Cixous argue. We don't have to actually arbitrate the question of whether there is sexual difference, but let's assume, following the entire history of Freudian thought or of Western thought more generally, let's grant the premise of sexual difference. Then the task becomes to actually specify what that difference is. The idea that the female sex might have its own specificity. What is it then to be a woman, or more particularly for Sik Su to write as a woman, to think as a woman, if we are granting the premise of sexual difference? We find over and over again in Sik Su and in the other French feminist theorists this exploring of this fact that in philosophical discourse, for instance, they are kind of invited to participate at the cost. The cost of admission is, in some sense, to assume a neutered, that is to say, a masculine standpoint. Any theory of the subject is already masculine, they argue. So how does one enter the philosophical room, the room of philosophy? How does one articulate, not feminist demands, but how does one, in some sense, speak as a woman? How does one raise those questions? So we find over and over again in Sik Su this playing around. And with Sik Su, I think what's given this project, the way in which she writes, the way in which she speaks is as important as what she says or what she writes about. So women must write, a woman must write herself, must write about women and bring women to writing from which they've been driven away as violently as from their bodies, for the same reasons, by the same law, etc., etc. I look at this interview. This is an interview from the days of Nicolas Sarkozy, a right-wing French president, and Sik Su is talking about both about women's studies in France and the fact that there are so, even as late as 2011, 2012, or when 2010, there are hardly any women's studies programs in France. But she's also talking about the wider scene. Notice how she moves from the particular articulation of a women's studies professor to the wider political environment.
France is the most misogynistic country in Europe. It's very conservative, and particularly in the academia, it's the same old rules of rejecting everything that has to do with even thinking about or in terms of gender or sexuality. 2 days ago, there was a large symposium on my work, The Love of the Medusa, in La Sorbonne. So we were introduced ceremoniously in that enormous place where one could sit 300 people. And I was looking at the walls that are covered with frescoes. And all around the walls were painted a number of dignitaries of La Sorbonne, about 100 men sitting majestically. I was looking at that, and inwardly it made me laugh, because what you had as a symptom was the representation of the past and present of La Sorbonne as all men. I thought it was an illusion, because on the wall at the other end there was a kind of light. It was a silhouette, a light silhouette, and a silhouette of light. I was told that this was an allegory of justice, and that was woman. It's a real picture of the gender situation in all scenes of culture. 100 men sitting like that, and the flame of the future, of somebody you dream of, but that is not to be found in society. You look for it, you pant for it, you desire it, it's the ideal. it's to come, as Derrida would say, it's democracy to come, justice is to come. And it's female. As to the Women's Studies program that I inaugurated in 1974, and which is the only one, the only doctorate in France that deals with gender, it's still the only one, because it still is marginalized by the institution. It's still there, it still resists, and the government does everything it can to stifle it and probably wants to eliminate it. We're just in a season of demonstrations, strikes, indignation of the people against the government, which is really a government that wages war against culture. We're adopting the American ways of managing what should not be managed as business, but cared for as being the future of mankind. We're going this way, and this government is absolutely destroying the treasure that France had. I mean, even the rights of men and women are not safe in France anymore. People say it's about retirement, it's not true. It's just the spark for a huge indignation, because this government sides with the capital, wants to cut the budget on the poorer classes, on those who have worked for the wealthy. I mean, it's really a shame. It's really a shame, and really the majority of the French are in the streets now, and they, you know, for them it's a real sacrifice, because every day that they don't work is, of course, a day off their salary, and the salaries are very, very low. When one strike goes down simply because it goes to ashes because people are out of breath, another one is kindled somewhere else. So it's a difficult but beautiful moment, really, where we all take part. As a university person, I take part. As belonging to the Théâtre du Soleil, my theatre, we're in the streets. And the strange thing is that the Théâtre du Soleil has fashioned a huge and an immense and beautiful figure, a kind of puppet, but it's like a statue alive. And it's the embodiment of justice. So every time there's a demonstration, there's a next act in the history of justice in France. I'm sure that we're going to have to walk through a desert for a generation before.
I think with Cixous, very clearly you see, I mean, here she's of course talking in, is it a fifth language? I'm not sure. So she of German origin, French speaking, but lives for much of her, Jewish, lives for much of her childhood in Oran, in Algeria. So is speaking Arabic and a certain degree of Berber also. But so German, French, some Yiddish, and Arabic. Before English, so that the her English is idiomatic but heavily inflected, obviously. But I think the kind of the precision with which words are chosen is clear enough in what she does. Also, the use of the body in speaking. So the obviously speaking is not dematerialized in Cixous, but notice also the particular ways in which she will encircle a concept in some sense. She will come at it in a variety of different ways. So she will say the same thing from three different angles, as it were. So one understands this is not, as it were, it's a rejection of a certain phallocratic nature of phallocratic understanding of discourse as saying true things as were succinctly as though there were no remainder to them. That's the opposite of what Sik Su believes. Here, for instance, terror, the impossibility of living. Notice the way in which the language works. Firstly, we notice just on the page the number of questions for a start. So don't you too, ask yourself, who am I? Who will I have been? Aren't you like me, constantly struggling to fall into the trap? But the involvement of the reader, the forcing of the reader into the frame constantly, the refusal, in other words, of an objectivistic kind of register in Sik Su's work, and then also the playfulness of the language as it begins to move through certain kinds of registers, having raised the question of what it is, or what it is to be a child, so a child in a sense minoritized, a woman also minoritized, a Jew minoritized in predominantly Catholic and fairly deeply anti-Semitic France, and of course in Algeria before that, you too a Jew woman. Trifling, diminutive mouse among the mouse people, assigned to the fear of the big bad cat. The reference here, I take it, is to the Spiegelman's famous cartoon Mouse. This is Art Spiegelman. These are the first two books. A Survivor's Tale, one, My Father Bleeds History, two, And Here My Troubles Began. If you haven't read Mouse, you ought to. It's a fabulous account. This is by a New York Jewish survivor. More particularly, it's his father's story, and we see here that the mice, who are the Jews with the pajamas in prison, the big bad cats would be the Nazis behind them. But to the diaspora of your desires, to the intimate deserts, and if you grow, your desert likewise grows. If you come out of the hole, the world lets you know that there's no place for your kind in its nations. There's a very, very acute sense in Sik Su's work of the experience, the existential experience of marginality, of not belonging, of how do you, it isn't a question for Sik Su, as it were, of just reading and then, because she's brilliant, of taking her place in the cathedrals, in the museums, in the university. Something more is involved there, because she could, as it were, take her place, but she would that she's always, if she takes her place, she's always a quasi-man or nobody. How does she in fact take her place in those institutions in which 100 men are on the walls screening what she can do? Hitler, the Jews are undoubtedly a race, but they are not human. This is a totalitarian formulation, which makes it absolutely impossible. Sik Su is working with a more mediate notion. Of course, the Jews are human, but what kind of humans are they? You might say. Here in this portrait, I say Alemania, which I won't play. Just look it up yourself. But she's playing with the idea of that. She says Alemania. I say Germany. But of course, she's talking about the fact that the moment you say that Al, if you spend time in the Middle East, you're thinking Arabic. Al-Alamein, for instance, or Al-Andalus itself, that particular sense of the relationship between, for her, is Alemania a place of longing, a place of flight? What is Germany for her? How is she to think through her Arab experience, or if you like, I mean, at least her Maghrebian experience, the Algerian moment for her. I'm thinking also of the way in which she talks about exile and how linked this is to somebody like Adorno, but with Adorno who doesn't push it through to the fully, because Adorno is talking about being Jewish, and therefore fleeing. And so talks about writing. For a man who no longer has a homeland, writing becomes a place to live. It's almost as though for Adorno, one sets a house inside one's writing. For Cixous, it's a little more radical than that, I think, even. Of course, she sets a house inside her writing. But what that house is not a recreation of the house you used to have back home. Because the house you used to have back home is the problem as well. She gets thrown out of a cathedral in Cologne. It's true that I had bare arms, or was it a bare head? Naked, I felt naked for being Jewish for being naked for being a woman, Jewish for being flesh and joyful. This again, think of the form of rhetoric involved here, the kind of apparent repetitions, but not quite of the same. The way in which meaning develops slowly through these things as you begin to think of the kinds of links. So I'll take all your books, but the cathedrals I'll leave behind. Their stone is sad and male. That particular moment where she's beginning to think, she's playing with the language of sexual difference. How can stones be male? They can't be, of course. She knows this, but she's attributing sexualities to things as a kind of gesture to show the effects of sexual division. The way I might have prayed in a cathedral, sending their god an imposter message. And then we can talk about some of these in class. One of my favorites, I suppose, is this one of what's the point of excusing yourself, where you hear the difficulty that, in other words, the moment you speak, what speaks in that space is your sex, which discriminates against you, which disqualifies you. So you can't excuse yourself. You always excuse yourself. And she begins with this notion of any theory of the subject is necessarily male. So instead of saying ladies and gentlemen, gentlemen, because they are gentlemen who are gentlemen, but then the other gentlemen who are ladies, as it were. Gentlemen, ladies, gentlemen. Everybody is a gentleman, but some are men and some are women, as it were. I'm ceaselessly struggling with your internal difficulties, and I feel advanced that I am in the wrong rightly, so to speak. My writings really have no raison d'être. They can't exist in some ways. So think this through. Here, talking about dreams, we see this interest, the playfulness towards Marxism, towards psychoanalysis that runs through much French feminist theory has to be understood. So this is a performative politics. In some way, it works through gesture, exaggeration. It works through remainders, through what doesn't fit. It's ludic, it's playful at all times. You could imagine a very kind of serious-minded, particularly I suppose, Anglo-Saxon reader. That's the French way of conceiving this figure. This person who cannot understand irony. Perhaps you have to imagine an American, maybe, who's saying something, something like when confronted with the Marguerite, saying, but it is a pipe, or why can't you speak, etc. So worldwide my unconscious, if we think of that notion of the, worldwide my body, made globally, but what happens outside happens inside, etc. I envelop myself and contain myself, and so on. Let's distinguish, just going back to this sense of the difference that I've sometimes tried to draw between objectification and objectivation, I've said, relating perhaps in the longer history to the two concepts of mimesis, of mimicry, if you like, in Plato. Mimesis is production, and mimesis is already caught up, says Irigaray, of imitation, specularization, adequation, and reproduction. That is, what's involved in the production of scientific concepts? Do scientific concepts, do concepts go into their objects without remaining? That's a notion of what in philosophical discourse is called adequation. The best concepts in that model fit into their objects without remainder. It's almost as though they're made for their objects. And what Cixous and the French feminists in general are emphasizing is a different notion of mimesis, one which is production, one which emphasizes the making, which will never allow a concept to go into its object without a difference, without remainder, without non-identity. Identity is not the goal. Difference is the goal, or at least non-identity, if you like. I'm going to skip over the essentialism. I want just to say something about Asya Jabbar, also in this context. Has anyone read Jabbar's novels? She's such a died, sadly, I think last year or the year before. Fabulous writer, might have won the Nobel Prize, I think. Some extraordinary work. And when Jabbar comes to talk about Jabbar, obviously an Algerian, Arabic, Berber, and so she also talks in a different way, not as a Jew, but as an Arab woman, but talks about a relationship to French, French is a particular language, and what is her relationship to it. So it was, for me, with the French language, think also of Cixous here, I think. Should a man venture to describe my eyes, my laughter, my hands? Should I hear him speak of me in this way? I risk losing my composure. Then I immediately felt I had to shut him out, make him feel, by the way I started, that he had made a false move. It should be worse, he was intruding. Afterwards, I suffered from the misunderstanding. When I protected myself from flattery, it wasn't because of virtue or prudish reserve. I discovered that I too was veiled, not so much disguised as anonymous. Although I had a body just like that of a Western girl, I had thought it to be invisible in spite of evidence to the contrary. So she's talking about how do you exist in this language imposed on you of French. And of course, Cixous thinks the same sorts of things. French is her mother tongue, but it's a mother tongue through a historical process of uprooting, of deracination, leaving Germany, moving to France via Algeria, in the sense of does Frenchification require de-Jewishization, as it were? What's involved in this process for her? And in Jabbar's case, also the sense of how deep down do you have to go to get to the mother tongue? What's the mother tongue for Cixous? How does French speak her? With Jabbar, she focuses on the fact that there is French, which is the language for her of love, but also the language of colonial domination. There is Arabic, but which Arabic? The Arabic of the Quran, Arabic of the courts, the Arabic of certain schools, or her home. But in her home, she doesn't speak Arabic, she speaks Berber. So we've got these kind of movements in and out of language, where language is language expresses you. You are who you are through language. But language is such a complicated inheritance for her. Finally, just this formulation in Fantasia. How could a woman speak aloud even in Arabic? The novel, if that's what it is, because it's a strange kind of novel that tells the history of Algeria from 1830, when the French invaded, to independence in 1960, let's say. That process of 130 years of domination is the story against which, and Jabbar is also an oral historian, like Cixous, or tells the story, bring women to writing, or bring writing to women, in some sense. And so she's talking here about the novel opens with a strange scene, or what for her is a strange scene, it's just her walking hand in hand. She says, imagine seeing a man walking hand in hand with his daughter, taking her to school. And so we think, yeah, right, so what? And then she talks about how extraordinary this is in the context of her rural Algeria, because girls don't go to school, and they're never taken to school by their fathers. So this peculiar sense of already, as she's gaining the resources to enter into philosophical discourse, to knowledge, the world of knowledge, the world of language, meaning French, so she is being alienated from her roots in some way. And Cixous articulates these kinds of things as well, that empowerment in one respect, disempowerment in another. So how can she undertake to analyze her childhood even if it turns out different? The difference, if not spoken of, disappears. You have to constantly talk about difference, but talking about difference, how do you talk about difference without being just thrown out of the cathedral? As for happiness, my oral tradition, which of course is another whole story here, of the language, of the relationship of speech to discourse. At the age of 11 or 12, I was abruptly ejected from this theatre of feminine conferences because she had become educated. She had become a man, in a certain sense, through her education. And the women in the group, in the female compound, began to catch themselves when talking in her presence. Because she was from the outside, as it were, or that she could move into the outside. And that became, so the woman who goes into the public sphere, and I'm not talking just about the woman in Algeria, for Cixous it's the woman in general, how does she actually enter that space without betraying her sisters left behind? So these are the kinds of questions, the sorts of issues that Cixous is bringing. That, in fact, that the whole of French feminist discourse brings. I mean, you need to understand it as a sort of a playful context. It's I don't mean trivial or lacking in seriousness. I think it's profoundly serious. But it isn't only thetic. It doesn't only produce propositions, formulations. It can't be a systematic philosophy, she suggests. It has to be deconstructive. You have to jam the machinery before or even as you are remaking the world in some sense. Deconstructive, reconstructive together is the way in which this philosophy works. I did get through it all. But that's by leaving out large chunks. So if you just look again at some of the passages in Cixous that you found particularly great or problematic and so on, let's bring those to seminar and start there. See you tomorrow.